Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, welcome back to the Beis Medrash program, Birshus Rabbi Teitelbaum. We'd like to, first of all, thank the Friedmans, David and Tammy Friedman, for sponsoring this evening's learning. The Ilui Nishmas, David's father, Rabbi Morris Friedman, Harav Shmuel, Moshe ben Rav Yechiel, Dov HaKohen, Olav HaShalom, our downstairs Beis Medrash is also named for him. Our limud should be a very Chuzachus for his neshama, and it is once again a great privilege to have with us Rabbi Foreman. I think we've all had a hard time eating for the last week with all the questions that we were left with a week ago. So we're looking very much forward to the resolution of many of those questions as we continue on our quest of understanding the connection between Mishkan and creation. Without much further ado, Rabbi David Foreman.
Okay, so last week I suggested to you the possibility that the construction of the Mishkan may be related to the events of creation and may provide us a window through which to view Bereishit Perek Aleph, which is otherwise a difficult text to understand. I left you last week with a number of questions about the creation story, and the particular questions which we were focusing on was not so much those that are thrown into relief by the discoveries of modern physics, but those that anybody over the ages would have asked just looking at the story. The reason why we're focusing mostly on those kinds of questions is, again, because whenever you look at a text, the most interesting questions are the internal questions, the questions that the text itself wants you to ask, the text that the questions that on the face of it any intelligent reader would ask about the text. Those are kind of the windows that you crawl through to get into deeper meaning of the text. So we came up with a number of those kind of questions, as best of my memory serves me, a partial list. We were talking about this strange pre-creation world that sounds a little bit like the flood, the second verse in the Torah where we hear of chaos, we hear of darkness, we hear of a water world. And it's strange because although you and I are used to thinking of creation as a creation ex nihilo event, which is to say creation is the creation of something from nothing, but the Torah itself, at least according to the way Rashi understands it, doesn't seem to portray a something from nothing creation. It seems to portray the original pre-creation world as being a water world, a world that's dark, a world that's chaotic, but there's this pre-existing water, which is really strange. The question is, where did all the water come from? Everything else had to be created, but the Torah never says, and then God created water. There's just this water that's pre-existing. So how is it that we understand that? That was one question, one series of questions. And we also asked some questions about the sun. Two questions in particular having to do with the sun. The relationship of day 3 and day 4 we found to be odd. The sun is created on day 4 according to the Genesis chapter 1. And fruit trees are created on day 3. How do you get fruit trees without the sun? Moreover, the creation of the sun is described in terms that you and I would find strange. The significance of the sun, according to the Torah, is in its function as a calendar marker. The sun provides the ability for us to mark time. Of course, three out of the four ways that we mark time is directly a function of the sun, of light and dark patterns having to do with the sun. The four major ways that we mark time really are days, weeks, years, and months. Three out of four of those, which is to say days, years, and months, are functions of the light and dark cycles of the sun. Weeks are not. So the sun is very helpful as a calendar marker, but it's strange because, as I suggested to you last week, that's not how you and I would see the significance of the sun. The sun is significant because it provides us with heat, provides us with light. It's an energy source without which we die. If you don't have a calendar, you don't die. It just gets harder to exactly mark time. So why does the Torah characterize the creation of the sun the way it does? So these are some of the major questions that we raised last week. I want to now turn to, were there any others? I think these were the major ones. I want to now turn to the Mishkan and raise a few questions about the construction of the Mishkan. Some of them have to do with the Pshat. Some of them have to do with how Chazal, our sages, interpret the construction of the Mishkan. But there are a few very strange things, I think, about the construction of the Mishkan. Let me just lay them out very quickly for you. Number one is that at particular strategic points in the Mishkan, we find Kruvim, cherubs. Now, Kruvim are most obviously found in the Mishkan on top of the Aron. They're the two angels that come out of the Aron in the Kapores, the covering of the Aron. However, less known, perhaps, is the fact that the Kruvim appear in two other places in the Mishkan as well. Three-dimensional Kruvim appear on top of the Aron, but two-dimensional Kruvim appear woven into two fabrics. One is the parochas. If you look carefully, you find this in the text. The parochas, which is to say that the curtain that divides between the Kodesh Kodashim and the Kodesh, the Holy of Holies and the Holy, has Kruvim woven into it. And the Yeriot, the bottom level of the Yeriot, which are the curtains, there's three levels of curtains that blanket the Mishkan as a whole. So they had Kruvim woven into the fabric as well. So question number one is, why do Kruvim appear in the Mishkan at all? And why do they appear particularly where they do? Is there any rhyme or reason for the fact that Kruvim appear in these particular places in the Mishkan? In other words, you might just say, if it's just an aesthetic thing, that wouldn't it be nice to have some angels in the Mishkan? So why aren't they all over the place? You can imagine that would be a beautiful thing to have inlaid on the Shulchan. It might be a nice additional ornamental feature to include in the menorah. The menorah has ornamental features. So why is it that Kruvim specifically appear where they do? Is there any rhyme or reason for that? So that is question number one. Question number two if you look carefully, there are a number of things in the Mishkan that if you actually count up how the thing is assembled or woven, you'll find that the Mishkan includes a fair share of shatnas. The Yeriot in particular, and the Parochet, and even some of the Big Day Kahuna have wool and linen mixed in with them. It seems like a strange thing. If God doesn't like shatnas, you would think the place he for sure wouldn't like shatnas is in his own home. So why is it that the specific divine instructions about how to create this includes this thing that is supposedly so abhorrent to God, shatnas? A couple other questions. What clothes does the Kohen Gadol wear when he goes into the Kodesh Kodashim? As you may know, the Kohen Gadol only goes into the Kodesh Kodashim on Yom Kippur. Typically, he doesn't go in there. When the Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodesh Kodashim, he takes off what he would wear outside, which are his Big Day Zahav, and he instead puts on Big Day Lavan, which are white clothes. So the question I'm asking you is there any rhyme or reason for the fact that the clothes that he has to wear in the Holy of Holies are white? Now the Gemara takes this up, and the Gemara says, well, he can't wear his gold clothes because Ein Kategor Nasa Sanegor. It wouldn't be nice to wear gold when you approach God, specifically because gold reminds us of the golden calf. Not a good thing to bring up when you're talking to God. But if you think about that Gemara, the Gemara just explains why the clothes aren't gold. It doesn't explain why the clothes specifically have to be white. So the question is, why white clothes? Is it just a symbol of purity? Is there any meaning in the fact that they have to be white? That's another question. And now for some weird things. If you look carefully at the dimensions of the Mishkan, you'll find that the dimensions don't add up, which is to say that there's no room for the Aron. Okay, so the Aron is, I believe it's 10 amos, but there's 10 amos on each side of the Aron, and the width of Mishkan is only 20 amos, so there's no room for the Aron itself. The Gemara is aware of this, and the Gemara's response to this is that Aron Eina Minamida, which is basically that, the, as Rashi understands it, that the Aron didn't take up any room. So the question is, how exactly does the Gemara expect us to believe with a straight face that the Aron simply did not take up any room? Things usually take up room, right? I mean, like, that's the way it goes, you know? So, are we, you know, it seems like we're entering this magical world, a world that supposedly the Aron is, you know, it literally is magical. For those of you who read Harry Potter, you may be aware that there's this concept is in Harry Potter, right? This notion of this tent that is looks like very small on the outside, but once you get in it, it's very big. It seems like there's some weird stuff going on there. So how do we understand the fact that the Aron doesn't take up any space according to the Gemara? Similarly, another really weird thing, what's inside the Aron? So what's inside the Aron, of course, are the Luchos. The Luchos are supposed to be in the Aron. What do the Luchos look like? So there's a Medrash that says that the Luchos were, the Ksav, the writing, if you actually looked at the Luchos, you would see that the writing was Eish Shechora Agabi Eish Levana, right? Which is to say that the writing would look like black fire superimposed upon white fire. Now, that's a very psychedelic image. It sounds like you need to be smoking something to be able to really understand what that would look like, black fire superimposed upon white fire. It's a very surreal kind of image. What are we supposed to make of the notion that these Luchos are inscribed in fire in this kind of strange way, this swirl of black fire and white fire? Finally, one last question about the Mikdash, and I'll just summarize these so you'll kind of hopefully remember them a little bit. As you know, because we're in Shmos right now, so generally speaking, the implements of the Mikdash are succinctly covered. Well, not so succinctly, but they're covered in Truma and Tetzaveh, and then they're covered again in Vayakal Pikudei. So if you ever want to know where these things are, if you ever want to look up the dimensions of something or how something worked, you know, you can know where to find it. You can find it in Shmos. Strangely, there's this little tiny piece out in the middle of nowhere in Vayikra where two implements of the Mikdash show up again, and their function. I'm talking about at the end of Emor, right after the Parshas Moedim in Emor, you'll find, I'll just kind of read it to you so you get a sense of what I'm talking about. You have a chumash, you can follow it. But basically, the menorah and the shulchan show up at the end of the Parshas Moedim in Emor. It's kind of strange. It doesn't really seem to really belong. You go through all the Moedim, and then when you're done with them, you get, right, Vayidaber Moshe Moedei Hashem al Bnei Yisrael. That's the last words of the Parshas Moedim. Parshas Moedim takes you all the way through an entire chapter, chapter 23. And then immediately after that, Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemor Tzavas Bnei Yisrael V'yikoy Lech Hashem and Zayizach Kasis L'Maor L'Halos Ner Tamid. This command to that the menorah should be lit always, which is to say every night, all night long. All night long, over and over again, we hear that the menorahs of the menorah need to be lit tamid, constantly. And then right after that, and then we have the command to bake the lechem upon him and to put them into in 12 loaves, put them inside the shulchan. B'yom HaShabbos, B'yom HaShabbos Yarachenu. Every Shabbos you do this, and that also should be lifnei Hashem tamid, before God always. And that's it. And then, as if nothing happened, the Torah goes off into something else. The story of the Makala. So the question is, like, what is this doing here? I mean, you just finished talking about the Moedim of all things. And then you take this little detour into two particular implements of the Mishnah and their function. Notice you don't hear about anything else. You don't hear about the Mizbeach HaKetores, you don't hear about the Mizbeach HaKitzon, you don't hear about the Kiyor, you don't hear about anything, you don't hear about the Aron. All you hear about is the Shulchan and the Menorah in particular. It seems to have nothing to do with Moedim, it seems to have nothing to do with the Mekalel. It just seems to have dropped out of nowhere. So how do we understand these elements of the Mishnah that just show up in the middle of Vayikra? Okay? So that, in a nutshell, is my staple of questions about the Mishkan. Just to review, in case you're keeping score, why are the Kruvim where they are? Why does Shatnez appear in the Mishkan? Why does the Kohen wear white clothes inside the Mishkan? How come the Aron, the Holy Ark, doesn't take up any space, according to the Gemara? What's the deal with the black fire and the white fire on the Ten Commandments? And what are the Shulchan and the Menorah doing in the middle of Parshas Emor in Vayikra? Okay? This is a bunch of stuff. Now, what I want to argue to you is that, as crazy as it sounds, these questions about the Mishkan are going to be answered by the first chapter in Bereishis. Okay? And the questions we have in the first chapter in Bereishis are going to be answered by the Mishkan. Okay, that's going to be how it's going to work. Let me begin to show you how these texts interconnect and begin to shed light upon each other. Let's start with the Kruvim. Let's go back to the question I asked you. Why do the Kruvim show up where they show up? Let's just try to answer that question on the face of it. Why do the Kruvim show up where they show up in the Mishkan? The way we're going to answer is, Rosetta's going to ask, okay, let's look where the Kruvim actually show up. Let's see if we can find some sort of common denominator among those places, right? What do those places have in common, those three places that the Kruvim show up? But where are they? So the Kruvim are on top of the Aron. Right, they're coming out of the Kaporet. That's place number one. They're woven onto the Paroches that separates between the Kodesh and the Kodesh Kodashim. And they're woven into the fabric of the Urios, which are the covering for the outside of the Mishkan. Okay? What is the common denominator of those three places? What are the Kruvim doing? Curtains outside the Mishkan, the Parochas, and the Kaporas, as it were.
It's a separation between where you
can
go and where you
can't. So, let's not even say where you can't go and where you can't, but we'll just say there's separations, right? The Kruvim mark three separations of the Mishkan. You might say that separations mark gradations in Kedusha, right? So for example, the easiest one to see is the Uriot. What do the Uriot separate between? They separate between the outside world and the Mishkan itself. The Parochas, according to even the language of the text, is that it's there lahavdil bein HaKadosh and LaKadosh Kadoshim. It's there to separate between two levels of Kedusha, the Kodesh and the Kodesh Kadoshim. And we might say the Parochas is also, the Kapores is also there to separate. What is the Kapores? The Kapores is the covering over the Aron, and that covering separates between what? Separates between what's inside the Aron and everything else, what's outside the Aron. So we might say, if the Kodesh Kodashim is the holiest place, right? Maybe there's one place that's even holier, which is the inner sanctum of the Aron itself, would be the holiest place of all. So seemingly we have three separations here. Interestingly, there's a little bit of an interesting kind of orientation going on with the game, with these separations. When you were in school and you were learning about the implements of the Mishnah, do you ever get confused between the Parochas and the Kaporas by any chance? I know I certainly did. I always wondered why the Torah needed to come up with two names that sounded so much alike, the Parochas and the Kaporas. If you just switch two letters, you know, you got one another, I can never keep straight which one it is. Now, maybe there's a rhyme and a reason to that. There's a reason for that, because really the Kaporas and the Parochas really do the same kind of thing, right? They are both separators, right? As a matter of fact, if you think about it, the only thing that really distinguishes between the Kaporas and the Parochas is orientation. The Kaporas is the covering over the ark. What orientation is that? It's got a nice horizontal orientation. If you think about the Parochas, that separates between the Kodesh, it's the curtain that separates between the Kodesh Kodashim and the Kodesh. It goes the whole length of the Mishkan. It has a vertical orientation. So you have vertical separators, you have horizontal separators. And if we go to the third separator, which is the Urios, interestingly, the Urios are both horizontal and vertical because they lay over the Mishkan and they overlay over the walls. So they overlay over the top in a horizontal fashion, and then they drape over the sides of the Mishkan in vertical fashion. So you have this interesting kind of orientation thing going on with all of these separations. Why should Kruvim appear specifically at the crucial separation points in the Mishkan? Well, when's the last time you met Kruvim? The only other time you ever find Kruvim in the five books of Moses, Boys and Girls, is where? Yes. They are the angelic beings that keep us out of Gan Eden, right? All the way back in creation. So we actually meet the Kruvim as a function of creation. And if you think about Gan Eden, what was Gan Eden? We talked last week about the Mishkan being God's dwelling place on earth, but that's the dwelling place the people create for God. Before there was a dwelling place the people created for God, there was another dwelling place that God had on earth, which was the original Garden of Eden. The original Garden of Eden was God's summer home on earth. He planted this garden. What do you do in a garden? You hang out in the garden. That's why the text, remember that text, Vayishmu et kol Hashem mithalech bagad v'ruach hayom? Such a strange thing. And they heard the voice of God strolling through the garden in the afternoon. But the metaphor is that of a balabas who plants himself a garden. He's a nobleman. And you walk through the garden in the afternoon. So God, this is God's summer home on earth, right? So the original place of God is the garden. The replacement place of God is the Mishkan. And lo and behold, the Kruvim show up in both. After the sin after our sin in the garden, we were banished from Gan Eden. The angelic beings that make sure that we never return are the Kruvim. Those same angelic beings, they are there to make sure that we never return to the garden. But interestingly, those same beings that say that you can't get back to God's summer home only bar us from the summer home that God made for himself, not from the one that we would eventually make for God. God says, you want to make me a summer home? That's great, right? So that's fantastic. So the same angels that I used to keep you out of my home the first time, I'm going to have them usher you through all these barriers so that you can actually be with me in the place that you make for me. I'd love it if you make a place for me. So here are these angels, and we might say the Kruvim are barrier angels, right? Whether they're acting as stopping guards, right, in the Garden of Eden, or whether they're ushers in the Mikdash, one way or the other, they show up at barriers, and they're kind of barrier angels. Okay, so that's clue number one. Why are the Kruvim where they are? They seem to be at barrier points in the Mikdash. Why does that make such a difference? Why does that make such a difference? I mentioned to you before that I believe that Bereishis Perek Aleph is connected to the creation of the Mishnah story. And now, let me just point this out to you, that if the function of the Kruvim is to act as separators within the Mikdash, were there any separations in creation? Sure. Now, if you actually look, for example, at the language of the text for the parochas, lehavdil bein hakodesh lekodesh kodashim, you might be surprised to learn that the word lehavdil has not been used since creation itself. The word lehavdil appears in creation. How many separations are there in creation? Remember the separations of creation? Okay, so let's go through them. Separation, one separation is that we have the rakia, as you point out, lahavdil bein mayim lamayim, there was waters above and waters below, and there was this rakia, the sky in between them, that's one separation. Are there any others? The first separation is the separation between or and choshech, between light and darkness. Any other separations? Land and water, actually, you don't have the language of separation. The other time you have the language of separation is actually on day 4, with the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars. Lehavdil bein hayom ubein halayla, to separate between the day and between the night. So you have the original separation between light and darkness on day 1, the separation between upper waters and lower waters on day 2, and on day 4, the separation between day and night. Now, isn't it interesting that how many separation points are there in creation? There's 3. How many separation points are there in the Mishkan? There's 3. So now the question is that just a coincidence? Or might it be that the separation points in the Mikdash, that's not a coincidence? We'll just put it that way. Maybe that's not coincidental. If it's not coincidental, here's the really mind-bending possibility, could there be a correspondence between the 3 separation points in the Mikdash and the 3 separation points in creation? Now remember, last week we established that conceptually, creation and the Mishkan were sort of the same thing. They were both a creator acting to create a dwelling place for the one that he loved. That's what God was doing when he created the world for us, and that's what we're doing when we create the Mishkan for God. We're trying to create a dwelling place for him. So the question is, these 2 great creation stories in the Torah, the creation of a dwelling place, it's interesting that they both involve 3 separations. Could it then be that there is a correspondence between the separations in one story and the other? In other words, not just that in general terms there are 3 separation points in the creation and 3 separation points in the Mikdash, but could it be that there's a one-to-one correspondence between these separation points? That separation A, that they line up to each other, separation B line up to each other, separation C line up to each other. Could these things actually match up? It would be pretty wild if they would, but let's bear that in mind as a possibility. Let me begin to throw a fly in the ointment, this whole theory, a problem with it. But the problem, I think, is really the road to a solution to see it in a deeper way. What if I told you that, you know, this whole idea of that there's this link, or conceptual link, between creation and the Mishkan, because conceptually they're the same, isn't really true. I've been arguing that conceptually creation and the Mishkan is really the same, because in both cases there's a creator who's making a dwelling place for the one that he loved. But what if I said that, you know, the comparison really breaks down? Because when God creates a dwelling place for the one that he loves, he knows what he's doing, right? He knows people. He knows what they need. He knows the biology of a human being. He understands the constants of physics that need to be put into place to create an environment that actually works for a human being. So the notion of God making creation as an environment that's perfectly adapted to human life ultimately to arise is not something which is preposterous on the face of it, because God would know how to do that. But if you flip it around and you say, okay, but now when human beings are creating an environment perfectly calibrated for the existence of God to be present in this world, so that already is not a simple task. Because let's just understand what we mean by that, right? However you understand the Hasidic and Kabbalistic concept of tzimtzum, without getting into the subtleties and the difference between the Droz view of this and the Balatanya's view of this, but just to take things very simple, the Uncle Moishe song, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is really everywhere, according to everyone, isn't true. Okay? So in other words, Hashem isn't really here the way that you and I are here, right? He is the Makomo Shel Olam. He's the environment for the world. But basically, he's outside the system, right? I gave you my Monopoly analogy last week, I think. Did I give you my Monopoly analogy last week? I didn't give you my Monopoly analogy. I really didn't give you my Monopoly analogy last week. I'll give you my Monopoly analogy, right? You know, I was talking to an atheist guy. So he's, you know, wants to know, so where is God? If God really exists, so how come I don't see more of him? So I said, you know what you remind me of? You remind me of, like, you're playing Monopoly, and, like, Little Hat is talking to Little Shoe, you know, like the little icons on the Monopoly board. So Little Shoe goes, so do you believe in Parker? So Little Hat says, what are you talking about? It says, well, it says right there on the side of the board, made by Parker Brothers. You know, that's what it says on the Monopoly board. So do you believe in Parker? So Little Hat says, I don't know what you're talking about. So I guess I believe in Parker. So Little Shoe says, well, let me tell you something. I've been around here a long time. You know, every week I pass go, I collect my 200. I've seen it all. I've been to Tennessee Avenue, St. James Place, Park Place, landed on free parking, even spent time in jail. I've seen the board. I ain't never seen Parker. So I'm a Parker atheist, you know? I don't believe in Parker. So what would you say to Little Shoe? You know, you'd say, my dear Little Shoe, you know, you're looking for Parker in all the wrong places. You know, Parker's not on the board. He's the maker of the board, right? So however Parker made the board, it's like he exists outside the board. So it's like, yes, he's mashgiach upon the board. He has influence on the board. He makes the rules for the board. He cares about what's happening on the board, all of that, right? But he's not one of the icons floating around the board, right? That's you and me. So once you understand that, the notion of Little Hat and Little Shoe getting together to try to make a place for Parker on the board seems kind of ridiculous. It's like, how are they, you know, you can understand Parker making Little Hat and Little Shoe, but you can't understand Little Hat and Little Shoe coming up with a place that Parker could actually live in on the board, right? But nevertheless, that's what the Torah says. So, Asu Li Mikdash, the Shachatu B'Socham, that God is actually going to take up residence here, like he took residence in the Garden of Eden. So you might say, well, how are we going to do that? You don't know the conditions. And I was like, you want to make God comfortable, right? So what are you going to do? Try to replicate the conditions of God's native habitat outside of the universe, outside of space and time, whatever that is, right? You don't know what that is. You live in this little fishbowl called the universe. You don't have a way of peeking outside the universe to even have any idea what it would take to have a place, an environment that would work for God. So it's preposterous for you to believe that you could create such a thing. So this idea that creation of the world and of the Mikdash are sort of the same thing seems to break down when you really start to think about it, because it's not really the same thing. Parker can make the board, but we can't make a place for Parker on the board, if you really think about it. Here's the answer, I think, to that question. Let's take a very simple kind of answer, a way of answering that question. Imagine you weren't trying to make a place for God in the world. Let's say you were trying to make a place for a human being, but you didn't know what that human being liked or what their native environment is. Right? Let's say you had some long-lost aunt who was going to come visit you for 3 months. Aunt Sadie. You never met Aunt Sadie before, but you're very excited to meet Aunt Sadie, but you know nothing about her. But she's your long-lost aunt, and she's going to be spending some time, and you have no way of contacting Aunt Sadie before she comes to your house. You really know very little about her. You know nothing about her. But you want to make Aunt Sadie comfortable. So you look around your house. You say, well, what rooms do I have that I could give as a guest room for Aunt Sadie? And the only room you have is little Jimmy's room. Right? Your 7-year-old has a room, and he's going to be spending time at camp. You know, so you can give Aunt Sadie little Jimmy's room. Okay, but your problem is you don't really know how to decorate in the way that Aunt Sadie would like. But what would you do to little Jimmy's room, at a minimum, even though you don't know anything about Aunt Sadie, to get it ready for Aunt Sadie's arrival? Little Jimmy's a 7-year-old, right? So what does his room look like? He's got a bunk bed. He's got, you know, New York Mets pennants around the place. He has his baseball glove on the floor. He's got a 7-year-old room. So what's the minimum you would do? Right. You would, at a minimum, get rid of all the stuff that Aunt Sadie's for sure not going to need. She's not a 7-year-old, right? So you're not going to have 7-year-old stuff in Aunt Sadie's room. So you might not know exactly what she likes, but you could at least give her a nice, clean room. You're not going to have it cluttered with stuff that she doesn't need. Okay, what if we applied the same logic to God? What if we said, okay, God, you're basically like Aunt Sadie. We don't know very much about you. But we do know one thing. You're not human. So the stuff that you created for us in this world, you don't need any of that stuff. So if we're going to prepare a place for you, the least we could do using the Aunt Sadie principle is clear out all the junk that you don't need, all the human stuff in the world that you don't need, which, if you think about it, is everything. That is the stuff of creation itself. What did God do in all of space and time and physics and all that? That God doesn't need any of that. That's all created stuff. So you would want to almost create an environment which is pristine, which gets rid of all of that, which means that if you really think about it, in a way, what we're doing in creation, what we're doing in creating the Mishkan, is similar to what God did in creation, which is we, like God, are making a dwelling place for the one that we love. But it's also the mirror image of creation, in the sense that, conceptually, everything that God did to construct the universe in creation, perhaps, we are trying to deconstruct in creating the Mishkan. I want to raise the following possibility with you. Could it be that the Mishkan is fundamentally a deconstruction project, not really a construction project? Which is that even though on the face of it, we use malacha to build a building, and malacha is a constructive activity, but conceptually what we're doing is we're not constructing but unconstructing the universe to arrive back at a pristine place that is the closest approximation that we can imagine of God's own world. Okay? Now, just follow me here, and let's just think, like, how would we do that? So they'd say, well, that's what the law's for. So we don't know what we're doing, but God gives us the laws how to create the Mishkan, and that's how we get to it. Yes, that may be true. But still, follow me into the logical process a little bit, and I think we'll see something possibly of the rationale behind the laws that the Torah is giving. Let's talk about construction and deconstruction. Deconstruction in the human world is usually like demolition, right? Like there's constructing a building and then there's getting rid of a building. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been involved in demolition, or if you've been involved professionally in demolition, or if you've gotten rid of a home or anything like that. But let me give you a demolition puzzle. Imagine that you're called upon, you're a demolition expert, and you were called upon to demolish a 50-story building in Manhattan. Okay? Now, it's in the middle of Midtown. You want to do this as efficiently and as quickly with as little mess as possible, right? You don't want this huge explosion scattering debris over a 20-block radius, right? So you're going to use explosives to bring down the building, but you want to do it in a way that the building just sort of collapses in on itself in a very nice, efficient way with a minimum kind of footprint. What's the strategy? Where do you put the chargers? Let's say you've got three chargers and only three sticks of dynamite. Where are you going to place those three sticks of dynamite to give it your best shot of bringing down the building as cleanly as possible? Where?
Inside the building.
Inside the building. Where inside the building?
The base.
Okay, the base. So basically what you do, and for those of you who've ever done construction in your homes, you ever like bring in the architect or something, you're talking about moving walls around, and he or she says, you can't move that wall because that's a load-bearing wall, right? So at strategic points in your house, there are load-bearing walls. Load-bearing walls are the infrastructure of your home. Every building has an infrastructure. The purpose of the infrastructure is to provide some sort of skeleton that the rest of the building revolves around. If you place your chargers strategically at strategic places in the infrastructure to destroy the infrastructure, then the superstructure, everything that's built upon that, is going to come collapsing down very nicely and neatly. So if you're doing deconstruction, what you really want to do is you want to get rid of the infrastructure of the building. Here's what I want to suggest to you. I want to suggest to you that if you think carefully about creation, when God created the world, it might be that when God created the world, he was actually doing two things, not one thing. He wasn't just creating. But if you look carefully at Genesis chapter 1, you'll find that there's two different kinds of things that God is doing. There's infrastructure building, and then there's superstructure building on top of the infrastructure. What I want to suggest to you is that the superstructure building is the stuff that's visible. The same way that when you're building a building, so the building only looks like it's taking shape in the superstructure, because the infrastructure is just the stuff that you need to be there in order to be able to build around it. So too in creation. So in creation, whenever you get to a verb like vayivra or vayas or vayitzer, that God created or God made or God formed, those are superstructure words. That's when God is actually building the stuff of creation that you and I know. But there's also words that indicate infrastructure development. There are words that are verbs that God does in creation that as a result of this verb, nothing new is actually created, but God is still doing it. There's one verb in particular that I'm thinking of that you find a number of times in creation, three times in creation, but every time you find it, nothing new is created. God's just moving stuff around so as to be able to build more efficiently on top of it. The word, the verb I'm thinking of is vayavdel. Those are the havdalah. Whenever God separates, God isn't actually creating anything new. He's just dealing with stuff that's already there, putting this over here and that over there. And that's an infrastructure development. I got to do that in order to be able to build, on it. I'm not actually making anything new. What I want to suggest to you is that the three separation points in both the Mikdash and creation are actually the infrastructure points in the building. They're the infrastructure points in creation itself, and correspondingly, they're the infrastructure points in the Mishkan. What I want to do now is actually read through the creation story very quickly in Genesis chapter 1 with a focus on the infrastructure points. And what I want to do is see if we can define infrastructure point A, point B, and point C. I mentioned to you before that it's possible that there's a one-to-one correspondence between the three infrastructure points in creation and the three infrastructure points in the Mishkan. If there is such a correspondence, if we want to understand what these infrastructure points were, right? Because we understand the nature of infrastructure point A, infrastructure point B, and infrastructure point C, we'll be able to see how it corresponds in the other buildings. So if we can identify it in creation, we'll understand how it's functioning in the Mishkan as well. Each will be able to kind of shed light on the other. So let's read through creation and try to focus on these Havdalah to try to understand what it is that they are. Now here's where I'm going to get to what I talked about at the very beginning last week, which is trying to arrive at a way of understanding the first chapter of creation in a way that makes sense to a 21st century educated person. Right? Going back to our original question, how do you come up with what seems like the very fairy tale-like story of creation, which is just given in 20 or so verses, which is somehow supposed to correspond to the very sophisticated scientific analysis which we've come to today in a world of relativity, in a world of quantum mechanics, in a world of the laws of physics as we know them, in a world of the Big Bang, all of that kind of stuff. Is the Torah talking about that world or not? And again, just to remind you, what I suggested to you last week was that, look, one way of reconciling Torah and science at its most basic is to just say, look, these are two different stories. The Torah is not a science book. It's not a history book. It's a guidebook. And so the Torah is not going to talk to you in a scientific kind of way about things because it's not interested in telling you science. It's going to try to guide you. It's going to talk to you. It's going to try to guide you. What would that mean? It means it's going to talk to you in more anthropomorphic terms. It's going to talk, or more anthropocentric terms, which is to say that the human being is the center of things because we're talking to human beings. Let me just explain what I mean by that. If you take a scientific view of the universe, right? From a scientific standpoint, the human is not the center of the universe, right? We once thought humans were the center of the universe, the heliocentric theory, the geocentric theory of creation, then we understood that no, the Earth is not the center of everything, right? Until we're where we are now. What is the Earth? The Earth is the third rock from a pretty ordinary star in a pretty ordinary galaxy that has 100 billion stars in it. And that galaxy is one of 100 billion other galaxies in the observable universe, just at the edge of a really normal kind of supercluster of galaxies. And you think, like, all right, like, you know, how important really are we? We're really pretty much nothing, you know, anochi afar ve'efer, so to speak. That's one view. That's a scientific view of creation. Man is not the center. Man is irrelevant. But from a religious standpoint, man is the center. If you look at the creation story, it's the ultimate thing is creating man. It kind of all revolves around the creation of mankind. Now, that's understandable. If the Torah is a guidebook written for humans, so I'm talking to humans. If I was talking to birds, so birds would be the center. You know, if I'm going to talk to humans, so I'm going to talk to you about your role in the world and what it is that you're supposed to do here. So we would expect a guidebook for humans written by the maker to present humans in an overly anthropocentric way where everything revolves around them. That would kind of make sense. But now the question I sort of left you with last week was, all right, but maybe it's true that the Torah presents things a little bit differently in the creation story to teach us things about creation that we need to know to understand ourselves. But sof kol sof, if there was a creation event, and it was something like science says, that 13 billion years ago there was a Big Bang and everything developed the way science says it developed, right? So we would expect that somehow what the Torah is talking about relates to that. Like, somehow, and like, you should be able to, like, see the seams, see how something about what the Torah is saying relates to that, but yet it doesn't. In the world of pre-creation, right, pre-creation seems to be very different in the Torah's construct than it does in the scientific world. In the Torah's construct, there was darkness, there was lots of water, there was chaos, right? Those are the three elements of pre-creation. If you go to Einstein, what does pre-creation look like, right? Pre-creation looks like, I mean, if you just so we understand, right, the scientific view of creation, more or less, your sort of like 60-second summary is, right, once upon a time, there was nothing, right? Like really nothing, right? Nothing. Like not like void nothing, like out in the space, like that. See, if you're out in space, interstellar space, there's still something, right? There's space and time itself, which is dimensionality, that even exists. But like nothing really means like nothing. It means not only no stuff in the universe, it actually means scientifically no space, no time, just really nothing. And then for some unexplainable reason, there's this huge explosion, there's this big bang, where basically everything that was going to be the universe was compressed into an ultimate black hole, this infinitesimal point. That point explodes and starts expanding. And with it, space and time itself are created, and there everything is subatomic particles, and those eventually coalesce and cool down a little bit so that visible light is available. After that, those subatomic particles will coalesce into the simplest atoms, which are hydrogen. Hydrogen over time will coalesce through gravity into clouds. Gravity will cause those clouds to contract still further. The friction will heat up the hydrogen to the point that you'll have thermonuclear explosions. That's going to be a star. And then you have the birth of stars. Eventually, stars will exhaust their hydrogen fuel. As they do, gravity will cause them to contract still further. If the star is big enough, that final contraction, the death throes of the star, will cause an explosion, which is known as a supernova. In a supernova, you have the creation of all the heavy elements, and zinc and carbon, all that stuff gets thrown out in the universe. You've got planets. Before you know it, you've got yourself a universe, right? So how does that correspond to what we've got in Gracious Bar Elohim Esser Shemayim Vesar? It's like, you know, how does that even work? Like, okay, fine, so it's a guidebook, but like, show me something. Okay, so what I suggested I was going to do with you last week, this week, was this. We were going to actually try this almost algebraically, right, as crazy as it sounds. What we were going to say was, okay, let's imagine that if the Torah is presenting a guidebook to humans, what that means is that the Torah is talking about the actual events of creation. Let's call those the scientific events of creation. But it provides an anthropocentric overlay onto that, which it makes it more understandable to human beings. It's talking to humans, so it's a human approach, a human lens through which to view those things. So if you ever wanted to get back to the science, what you would have to do is you'd have to factor out the human lens. So it's almost like imagine an algebra equation, and the equation went like this. The Torah's view of science equals science as a function of humans' way of seeing things, right, equals the Torah, right, T equals, right, science to the function of humans, or science times humans' way of seeing things. But if you can factor out the human way of seeing things, if you divide both sides by humans, you would just get science, right? That's what we're going to try to do. So what we're going to try to do is take these events and try to shift perspectives on these events, saying, okay, the Torah is talking to humans. If you factor out the human perspective, what's the Torah really talking about? So let's go back and pay attention to these three infrastructure developments, try to identify what they are. Here we go. Bereishis bara Elokim Esser Shamayim Vetzar, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Pre-creation. Pre-creation looks like three different elements. The three different elements are A, bara Zayta Tov Avo, chaos. B, Choshech Al Pnei Tehom, darkness. C, Ruach Elokim Rachefet Al Pnei Hamayim. There is this wind of God hovering over the waters. There's waters everywhere. So it's chaotic, it's dark, there's water everywhere. Then all of a sudden, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or. All of a sudden, let there be light. I mentioned to you last week that if you created a mental image of this, right now, you're in your head, it should be looking like this overexposed ocean, overexposed photograph of an ocean, like a really chaotic ocean, right? Because that, remember, pre-create was really dark, really chaotic, there's water everywhere, so there's waves, really dark. But then someone turns on the lights, Vayehi Or, So now it's like really brilliant, right? It's like very, very bright. You can barely see how bright it is, but still water everywhere, still very chaotic waves, but at least you can see everywhere it's very bright, which makes the very next words kind of strange. Because the very next words are, after Vayomer Elohim Yihor, Vayihor, Vayar Elohim Azor Kitov, right after that, Vayavdel Elohim Bein Ha'or Bein Ha'Choshech. God separated between the light and the darkness. Now, based upon your mental image of the scene, which you had in your head, what question do you have on this verse? What darkness? You just turned on the lights. Right? So, like, if I know anything, I know it's very light, because God just created this very brilliant light. So, that banishes the darkness. So how come there's this darkness now that God needs to be mavdil with? So this is something that the Rishonim struggle with. And based upon a pasuk in Yeshayahu, which I won't get into now, one of the approaches in the Rishonim, I think of the Sephardim's approach, is this. That the darkness that we're talking about here is not the darkness that you and I talk about when we talk about darkness. When you and I talk about darkness, the darkness that we talk about is characterized by the absence of light. The definition of darkness is no light. Now, if that's the kind of darkness we were talking about, once you turn on the lights, what happens to that kind of darkness? It goes away, because if darkness is no light and I shed light, so then now it's not dark anymore. But that can't be the kind of darkness we're talking about. We must be kind of talking about the kind of darkness that doesn't go away when you turn on the lights. A kind of darkness that would remain present even once lights are turned on, that wouldn't be affected by the turning on of light. That's the kind of darkness the Sforno says it was, which is darkness that is not characterized by the absence of light, but by the presence of darkness, which is to say that darkness is a thing. It's not the absence of something, but the kind of darkness we're talking about is an actual presence of darkness. There's this thing, it's called darkness. When you turn on the lights, all that happens is that the light energy is going to end up merging and mixing with this dark energy, right? And at that point, the very first thing that God had to do was he had to separate between these two great sources of energy, which is light energy and dark energy. And when he did, and he actually created this new product, which is a refined version of light. In other words, light, which is refined because it's now been separated from this other dark energy. So this dark energy is put somewhere else, and light as we know it is created after the Havdalah between light and darkness. The original light was not light as we know it. That was light which was mixed together with dark energy. But there was then this break between light energy and dark energy, with light as we know it being created at that moment. That was the very first Havdalah, the Havdalah that creates light as we know it. Okay, now let's go to the scientific view of events. If you read the current science, you will find that there is a mysterious feature of our universe. Scientists have found that if you add up all of the matter and energy in our universe, unfortunately, there's not enough of it. Right? It turns out that gravitationally we can see the presence of some other stuff out there which we cannot measure, which we cannot see. Which is that if you take all of the hundreds of billions of galaxies, with all the hundreds of billions of galaxies and stars and all that, and you add it up, it's still only about 21% of what's actually out there. The other stuff that's actually out there cannot be detected. The reason it cannot be detected is because whatever that stuff is, it is impervious to light. Light does not affect it. Hence, scientists have named the other stuff dark energy and dark matter, which accounts for about 80% of the universe. I kid you not, you can actually read it. Okay, it's there. Now, it has to be there, because if it weren't for that, we wouldn't have a universe, because we're very fortunate to be in a universe that has the gravitational structure that it has. And if you didn't have dark energy, we wouldn't be living. So dark energy is very important to have, but it's dark. It cannot be detected with light. So that means that it does not reflect light, it does not absorb light. Light It just, light is irrelevant to it, hence it's called dark. The theory I want to suggest is the very first Havdalah that the Torah perhaps is talking about is the breaking apart of two kinds of energies, light energy and dark energy. And that, and dark energy is where it is, and light as we know it only comes into existence with that very early break in the first moments of creation, which is the great first infrastructure development, which is the creation of light itself. What's the next infrastructure development? Next thing we find, and by the way, what's interesting is the Torah then tells us, you want to know what the names of these things are, light energy and dark energy. So the Torah says, "Vayikra Elokim la'or yom, v'la'choshech kara layla." So basically what's happening here? The Torah is offering you a human's view of this, right? So how are you going to talk to humans about light energy and dark energy? Right? They don't know from light energy and dark energy unless, you know, they figured it out after many thousands of years. But before that, basically God says, look, let me just explain it to you in terms you can understand. You know what a day is? You know what night is? Okay, that's the stuff I created in the beginning. Let's just call it day. Let's just call it night. Those would be the human words from human experience that we would use to describe what in fact is this light energy and this dark energy. And of course, you even see in the text, it's impossible that the original light is day and the original and night, because there is no sun yet. So it has to be metaphorical at some level, even at the face of it. But it sounds like God is trying to describe in as plain terms as possible something which isn't so plain. Okay, that's infrastructure development number one. What's infrastructure development number two? The next time you have Vayavdel is Vayomer Elokim Yehi Rakia B'toch HaMayim Yehi Mavdil Bein Mayim LaMayim. Okay, now remember we had this question about this pre-existing water. So there's this pre-existing water all over the place, and what does God do? God separates between waters, puts upper waters up here, and lower waters down here. Let's call the lower water seas, the upper waters is the water vapor or something like that, and what is in between it? Air, sky, rakia. Okay, now let me play a little game with you. Let's talk about the significance of that Havdalah. What does that Havdalah do? If we just take it at the simplest level, the level which the Torah is telling us, let's just accept it as something like this. The universe in its earliest state was full of water. It was just a complete water world. There was no air. There was no sky. It was just walls of water everywhere. All of a sudden, God came, and God separated between the waters. And from now on, there was going to be water down there. That was going to look like oceans. There's going to be water up there. That was going to look like clouds. But now you would actually have air. How happy would you be? And describe to me why you're happy. Why are you happy with the second great infrastructure development? What does it give you? It gives you oxygen. It gives you a place to be, right? Like you would say, like, I can't be in that water world. I'm not a fish, right? Like, I have no habitable human space. I need some space to move around, to breathe, right? A space that works for humans. So the second infrastructure development, the creation of sky in the midst of the waters, right, creates habitable human space. That's what the guidebook is telling you. That's the human perspective, habitable human space. Now, factor out the human perspective and what was really created with the second great infrastructure development. Not habitable human space, but what? Take out the words habitable and human, because those are the human perspectives on it. What did God actually create in the second infrastructure development? Space. It's the creation of space itself, which is to say, the ultimate way in which God gives you a place in which you can be is not just by providing this wonderful terrestrial thing called air, which just happens to be here in the third rock from the sun, but in the most ultimate way, the way that God gives humans a place to be, was he actually created a three-dimensional matrix for the universe, which is a creative thing called space. Again, go to science itself. Science agrees that space came into being. Space is a creation. There's something called the fabric of space. Einstein's physics is all about the bending of the fabric of space. It's there, right? It's the ultimate creation. It's the ultimate place in which we live. Now, it's hard to talk to humans before Einstein about the creation of this three-dimensional fabric of space. So if you want to talk about it to human beings, you're going to put it in overly anthropocentric terms. So God says, okay, let's just see it as, like, imagine that everything was water, right? What would water correspond to in this, right? Water is what was there before habitable human space. That means that what water corresponds to in this picture is the absolute void, right? In other words, before there is anything, right? That the Torah's metaphor for that is water. Then God creates this air, this space that you can be. That is how the Torah seems to be talking about the second great infrastructure development, which is the development of space itself. What's the third great infrastructure development? Third great infrastructure development happens on day four with the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars. Now let's get back to our question about the sun and the moon and the stars. The sun and the moon and the stars aren't, the sun is not described as a heat source. It's not described as there in order to give you energy. It's described as having one purpose only. It's there by ulaotot ulamoadim uluyamim ulashanim. It's there to provide a time marker for you, calendar markers for you, so that human beings can keep track of their seasons and keep track of time. So, what is the third great infrastructure development? The way the guidebook describes it is the creation of stuff that allows humans to keep track of time. So if we factor out the human part, what's the third great infrastructure development? Time. The creation of time. The three great infrastructure developments in creation are light, A, B, space, C, time. Now, if you actually go, the hour is late, so I can't get into this in detail, but if you do a little bit of reading in Einstein's theory of relativity, you will find that this is, in fact, true, which is to say, the three most basic infrastructure developments in our universe are light, space, and time. Now, the theory that I'm suggesting to you is that what the Torah is giving you here is not so much a chronological account of creation as a conceptual account of creation, right? Because in reality, light, or light energy as opposed to dark energy, the creation of that, the creation of space, and the creation of time seem to have been virtually simultaneous events in the milliseconds after the Big Bang. These are the things that allow our universe to be what it is. That having been said, though, if you read the literature on relativity, you will find that conceptually, some are more fundamental than the others. So conceptually, in Einstein's theory, light is actually a more basic feature of the universe than time and space is. And again, time, pardon the pun, doesn't really allow me to get into the details of this now, but just suffice it to say that when we talk about the theory of relativity, what the theory of relativity is really about, the fact that everything is relative, right? What everything is, the most basic things that are relative, are time and space, which is to say that if you want to know what time it is, so you can never know an absolute time, you can never know an absolute location, all of that is relative. What is it relative to? What it's relative to is actually your motion relative to a certain absolute standard, which just happens to be light. Light is the one thing that's not relative in the relativistic universe. The standard by which everything is judged is actually light. The speed of light is the standard for everything. It turns out, for example, that if you are moving at the speed of light, the closer that you move, so the closer that you get towards moving at the speed of light, funny things happen to space and funny things happen to time. For example, space contracts relative to your motion according to the speed of light. The closer you get to the speed of light, the more space contracts for you. The closer you get to the speed of light, the more time contracts to you, such that if you're a photon traveling at the speed of light, time actually goes to zero. and space. If you were in a spaceship traveling at the speed of light, the size of the spaceship would actually go to zero. So what happens is that you can't really even talk about space and time until you talk about light. Light is the fundamental infrastructure development. That is infrastructure development number one. After you have light, you can then have space. What is space conceptually? Space is a place in which to be. And then, if you think about what time is, what does time allow for? How do we interpret time? The way we interpret time is time allows for motion, motion through space. Let me show that to you in the Torah's text itself. In the Torah's text itself, if you actually go through what else happens besides the Havdalos? So after you have the creation of light, so then what happens? You then have the creation of space. And then after the creation of space on day two, you have this dry land, and then you have all the stuff that fills up space. You have dry land, you have oceans, and then you have a certain kind of life, vegetative life. That takes you through day three. For those of you who learned Masechta Shabbos, you're familiar with the idea of avos and toldos, right? There's avos malacha and there's a tolda, right? Which is the subcategories. Similarly, in creation, there's avos, so to speak, which are the great infrastructure developments of light, space, and time. And then there's toldos, the superstructure that rides on top of that. The superstructure that rides on space, for example, is if you had space, what would you do with it? You would fill it with stuff. So God then fills it with stuff. Vayas, God makes stuff. So God makes, there's this dry land. God makes vegetative life and fills the world, so to speak, with all the stuff that occupies human space. But once you have the next infrastructure developed on day four, conceptually, the creation of time, again, and I'm saying that this is my big argument here is that we're not actually looking even at a chronological view of creation, but a conceptual view of creation. Conceptually, first you had light, and then light allowed you to have space. Once you had space, you could fill space. And then once you add time into the picture, you could have something else. After day four, look at the new kinds of life that are created. The new kinds of life that are created on day five. Vayomer Elokim Yishritzu Hamayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya. Let the waters swarm. Listen to that verb. Let the waters swarm with life. V'of ye'of faith. Let things fly through the air. And let there be chaya romeses, hasher starts with mind. Let there be creeping things. What's the common denominator between things that creep, things that fly, and things that swarm in the waters? Motion. Motion is a function of time. Once you bring time into the picture, then you have movement through space, which is the next kind of life that exists. So this seems to be creation as the Torah lays it out. Let me just conclude, because the hour is late, take you back to the Mishkan and let you go home. The Mishkan is the inverse of all of this. Here's how it works. Our three great infrastructure points are light, space, and time. If we would want to go on a demolition project through creation to try to get rid of the created world so that Aunt Sadie would be comfortable in the world, which was the world of pre-creation. By the way, if you think about the world of pre-creation, the world of Tohu Vavohu, Tohu Vavohu, that pre-creation verse, has three elements which correspond to the absence of these three infrastructure developments. For example, Varetz Haita Tohu Vavohu, chaos. Chaos is what happens when everything is jumbled together, no time. Choshech, darkness. Darkness is when there's no light. And Mayim. Mayim is when all there is Mayim, without any divisions of air in between, no habitable space, right? Just the void. So what the Torah is talking about is a void that, what that verse is really talking about is a void that is created with no light, no time, and no space. And in that, creation somehow explodes into existence. Okay, getting back to the Mishkan. Let's just take a quickie, virtual reality tour of the Mishkan. So here you are, you're outside the Mishkan, you see the Mishkan in front of you. The first thing you see are the outside of these yiriyot, right? These curtains, where there's kruvim on them. You walk into the Mishkan, and all of a sudden you're on the Kodesh. And you look up, and you see the yiriyot on top of you, and you see those kruvim that are there. But what have you lost? Because you're indoors, what can't you see when you look up? You can't see the sun and the moon and the stars. The sun and the moon and the stars were the things that allowed for time markers. You're now indoors, so you've lost your time markers. Instead, all you see is those kruvim up on top. The last infrastructure development was the creation of time. Symbolically, as you go through the last Havdalah, which is the last barrier in the Mishkan, I've just lost the final barrier of creation, the barrier of time. I'm in a world with no time. So you say, how could I be in a world with no time? Well, as I stand here ready to go through my next barrier, I find that there are these two implements that are right in front of me in the Kodesh. They are the menorah and the shulchan. Now, the menorah and the shulchan were those things that showed up in Parshat Emor. Where did they show up in Parshat Emor? Right after the Parshat HaMoedim. Parshat HaMoedim. What was the sun and the moon and the stars there for? According to the Torah, to allow for Moedim, to allow for festivals. God says, I know you humans. You guys love festivals. I'm going to give you the sun and the moon and the stars. You'll be able to keep track of time and have your festivals. When do we actually have those festivals? In Vayikra, in the Parshas HaMoedim. So right after the Parshas HaMoedim, that we have our festivals, suddenly we have two Klei HaMishkan that relate to the festivals. Inversely, the festivals are the final celebration of time for human beings. But when we want to get back to God's world, we're erasing space, time, and light. We're getting rid of all of that. We're erasing time. How do we erase time? You erase it through something else. That's the opposite of Moed. What does Moed mean? We translate it as a holiday, but you know what Moed really means? What does Moed really mean? Moed actually means an appointment in time, a particular appointed point in time. That's Moed, a particular point in time. What's the opposite of a particular point in time? Anytime. You know what the Hebrew word for any time is, or all time? Tamid. That's the word that appears over and over again right after Parshat HaMoedim to describe the function of the menorah and the shulchan. The menorah is there to provide light, tamid, all night long, so that all time, there's no point in time, there's all time. Think about that. During the day, it's day. During the night, it's night. That's how you have cycles of time, night and day, night and day. You know how you erase time? How do humans erase the thing that God made? God made this great infrastructure development called the Ma'orot Berikiyah Shemayim that help us keep track of light and day by having these natural light and day cycles. You know how humans erase it? Through the menorah, artificial light at night, lighting up the night as if it were day, tamid all night long, so that all of a sudden it always looks light. So human artificial light destroys or disassembles. God created division between light and day, and therefore days, months, and years cease to exist in a world with a menorah. There's only one kind of time that still exists, which is weeks, because weeks are not a function of the sun. So you need another thing to get rid of it. And the other thing that you see in Vayikra right there is not the menorah, but the shulchan. And on the shulchan, there is what? There's bread that's placed there every week. And there's something funny about that bread, which is that the bread is always fresh. Why would that bread be always fresh without preservatives, even after 7 days? Because it's in a place where there's no time. You're in the world of no time. And what do? The man, through his malacha, right, creates bread, covers, what is bread actually? Bread is our processing of God's stuff, God makes wheat and all that. We process and make into bread. We cover all the stuff that God made on his malacha during his 6 days to erase those 6 days. So we erase weeks. So you erase weeks through the Shulchan. You erase nights. You erase days, months, and years through the menorah. We've gotten rid of time. But in front of you is the parochas. And the parochas is another barrier. It's going to be barrier B. What's barrier B? Barrier B, back in creation, was the infrastructure development, which we call space. You pass through this, and not only do you lose time, you now lose space. So something funny is going on, because you're looking at the only thing in this room, and it's an Arum. It's this holy ark. But you'll be darned if that thing is not taking up any space, because you're in the place with no space. So of course it's not taking up any space. Now you know why it's not taking up any space? Because what domain are you in? You've lost time, you've lost space, but the only thing in this domain is your first infrastructure development, which is light. You're in the world of light right now. Because you're in the world of light, how do you survive? If you're in a place without any space, without any time, you're like in outer space. How do you survive in outer space? Human beings can't survive in outer space. They need a space suit. Kohen Gadol needs a space suit too. What color is it? It's white. It's the color of light, because he's in the domain of light. So you have to dress up in light to be able to survive in the domain of light. So here he is in the domain of light. And do you know why? Because, and according to Einstein, if the only thing that exists in light from the perspective of light, when you're traveling at the speed of light, what happens to space? Space goes to zero. So does the Arum take up room? No, space goes to zero. So the Arum doesn't take up any room. Well, there's one final infrastructure development left. There's now kruvim that are not woven in two-dimensional, but actual three-dimensional lifelike kruvim right in front of you, covering over the last major barrier, which is the kaporis itself. If you would open the kaporis, you would go into another realm, another world, even farther removed from the earthly realm, where not only would space go away, not only would time go away, but refined light would go away also. Remember what happens if you take away that last barrier. The last barrier was the one that created refined light. But before there was refined light, what was there? There was light energy and dark energy swirled together. And as you're looking at the Ten Commandments, as the Luchot, according to Chazal, what are you looking at? You're looking at black fire and white fire swirled together. You're looking at black energy, dark energy, and light energy swirled together. That's the closest you can get to God's world. You've just undone creation, and you've gone back as close as you can to the earliest moments in the universe, which is as close as you can get to God's world. And the Aunt Sadie experiment succeeds. You say, God, really don't know what it's like out there, but we've done our job. We've gotten rid of everything we can get rid of, which is all of the infrastructure developments that you gave us that make our world available, right? And this is your world, and we ask God to dwell in it. And that is the approach that I want to give you. And with this, I bid you farewell. So thank you very much.
Last point you make. Explain something very, very strange. Don't bother.
Okay. Yeah. Which is...